This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Our big story, you know what it is. U.S. health officials in the FDA and CDC calling for an immediate pause in the use of J&J's single-dose COVID-19 vaccine. This after six women who received it developed a rare and severe form of blood clotting. Comes at kind of a difficult time, a crucial juncture in the U.S. vaccination effort. So let's get into what you need to know. Bloomberg News U.S. healthcare reporter Riley Griffin joins us on the phone in New York City. Also joining us, Dr. Mario Ramirez, emergency physician and managing director at the nonprofit Opportunity Labs. That is an organization looking to build opportunities for kids. Dr. Ramirez is also former pandemic and emerging threats coordinator at the Office of Health and Human Services during the Obama administration, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Great to have both of you here with us. Riley, I do want to ask you a few questions, though. This J&J news, tell us what we need to know, what the CDC is now looking into, and put it into perspective in terms of have we now maybe potentially lost another vaccine in the fight against COVID-19?
I don't think we're quite there yet. We have not lost the vaccine, but this pause is one of concern. We've found that six women between the ages of 18 and 48 who received the shot developed a severe form of blood clotting in the brain called cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. At least one had died and a second was in critical condition. But remember, this is out of more than 6.8 million doses of the single-shot J&J vaccine, which have been administered in the U.S. through Monday. What the FDA and the CDC are doing right now is investigating whether or not there's a causal effect. Right now, there is no definitive cause for the disorder, though FDA officials have said it seems very similar to blood clotting incidents that were seen with the AstraZeneca vaccine, which relies on a similar underlying technology called an adenovirus platform. And here they're thinking it may be tied to an immune response after vaccination that leads to an activation of platelets and clotting. But again, they are investigating this in real time. There will be a meeting of CDC experts tomorrow to discuss this further. But the pause could last a number of days, and that's where we're sitting and listening to the officials just like you, trying to wait and see what they find.
You know, I'm looking at some of the interviews, the coverage we've done. I'm looking at on social media, you know, all were women 18 to 48 years old. I've heard some things about birth control pills and blood clot risks. Is there anything that is true or is that a pathway that the CDC and the FDA are pursuing, or we don't know yet?
I will tell you this. That question was posed to the health officials at a 10 a.m. press briefing, and they said outright there's no reason to believe at this time that it was related to contraceptives. That was what they said when asked, but you know, I'm seeing the same things you are on social media. I would wait and focus more on what's going on with the underlying adenovirus-based technology more so than contraceptives.
Riley, hang on for a second. I want to come back to you in terms of the timeline and what we can anticipate. We'll hear from the CDC maybe over the next week. But Dr. Ramirez, great to have you here as well. Come on in on this conversation. What would be your concerns about J&J? What would you as a clinician, a physician, be looking into when it comes to finding out whether or not we've got a problem with this vaccine, or it's just potentially a statistically unfortunate set of circumstances?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Carol.
Yeah.
You know, I think Riley made a lot of great points, you know, in her last segment. So the first thing that I would say is that the risks that we have seen or the potential complications with some of these blood clots is statistically much, much lower than the number of blood clots that we see on an annual basis in this country or what we see even from oral contraceptives or from smoking. So for, you know, comparison's sake, we see between 400 and 600,000 cases of naturally occurring blood clots, these deep vein thrombosis in the U.S. population on a daily basis, on an annual basis. So that means that, you know, daily there are between 1,500 and 2,000 persons who are having naturally occurring blood clots. And so the question is whether or not some of the blood clots that developed in these persons who had received the vaccines, you know, were in fact linked to that, or was this a naturally occurring phenomenon and there was just an unfortunate overlap? So I think the important thing to remember, you know, whether you're a clinician or you're a patient who's potentially receiving these vaccines, is that we need to just take a deep breath, give investigators a chance to look at what the data says before we draw any conclusions. You know, I think the trials were well conducted and gave us good data about the safety profile. And now I think for the first time, we're picking up a potential signal and we need to let investigators do their job.
You know, one of the things I thought too, Riley, that was interesting, I watched the press conference with Dr. Fauci. It was around 1 o'clock or a little bit before 1 o'clock. There was a question said, if this is so important, why aren't we convening a meeting today, right now, versus tomorrow? And Dr. Fauci basically said, listen, we got to pull everybody together. But I feel like it was a fair point, right? I mean, the more tools we have, the more vaccines we have that are out there in the system, it's important to kind of get to the heart of whether or not we need to be worried. Just got about 30 seconds here. Your take.
Time is of the essence always. I think what we've heard from the Biden administration today is that they're not actually concerned about the rollout itself. Their ambition to get 100 million people vaccinated in May is not going to be disturbed by this pause, they've said. And so, you know, back to what it's so great to have a physician on the line with us too, but really, we don't want to rush the process. Whatever time is needed to investigate and convene is important.
Let's get back to Dr. Mario Ramirez, emergency physician and managing director of Opportunity Labs. It's a nonprofit, as I mentioned earlier, looking to build opportunities for children. He's also a former pandemic and emerging threats coordinator at HHS during the Obama administration, still with us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Dr. Ramirez, what are you seeing? We talked a lot about J&J. What are you seeing when it comes to COVID cases specifically in the vaccine rollout? And are you concerned that this J&J news might cause a slowdown in people's willingness to get the vaccine?
So the question of vaccine hesitancy is an important one. That's an issue that we've been, you know, discussing now for the better part of 6 to 8 months as we started to get a picture of what the vaccines were going to look like. You know, and I think the public has become increasingly comfortable with vaccination, which is, you know, quite important. And certainly this could potentially be a setback to those efforts. You know, but again, I think the most important issue is for people to give regulators a chance to take a look at the data and give us a really informed opinion about what the data shows before folks draw a specific conclusion. Now, your question about what we're seeing with overall case trends, you know, what we are seeing is that the greatest number of people that are being infected at this point are persons who are aged 20 to age 60, that group that has not been vaccinated yet, and particularly in hotspots like Michigan. That the growth in those groups, you know, is almost exponential at this point. And so it's still going to be really important, you know, even in light of this J&J news, that folks in that population group continue to get vaccinated as quickly as possible.
Yeah. You know, we've talked a lot about just kind of this balance between getting ahead of the variants, right, and getting the vaccine. I mean, we are kind of in a race against them, correct? Otherwise, we could set ourselves up for another wave here, or maybe we're going to have another wave because we just aren't getting it done fast enough.
You're right. I mean, that is a concern, and you know, a lot of folks have used that word foot race, and that's absolutely true. What I think we're seeing in some areas, like Michigan, is that we, you know, have lost that race, and that's why we're seeing surges in that, you know, those pockets of the country. But I think there's an important lesson there for folks to see. Right, which is that we have not vaccinated enough people, and there is not enough kind of nascent immunity from previous infection to fully prevent further surges. And so it's really important for folks to make sure and follow public health measures and make sure that they're instituting testing as a part of their kind of return to work or other activities to make sure and try and stay as safe as possible. Until we can get everyone vaccinated.
Well, that's an interesting point. And, it feels like the infrastructure is now largely in place when it comes to testing. And even when I've got a colleague who has a little bit of a cold or something is like, let me go get a test and let me just make sure it's not something other than allergies or a common cold. And I think we all appreciate that. Individuals do, because then they have a, you know, immediate knowledge of their own health, but they can also share that with their community and their colleagues. Testing is still an important part of this process, isn't it?
You're absolutely right, Carol. You know, I think one of the most unfortunate and disturbing trends over the last few weeks, though, is that the amount of testing that we're doing is going down. And, you know, what we've seen as a result is that the test positivity fraction is starting to rise up above 5%. And that 5% threshold is generally what tells us from a public health standpoint that we're actually testing and sampling an adequate number of people to really be able to track the disease spread. When we cross that threshold, we know that there's real disease that's potentially spreading that we're not picking up. You know, and so I think the message that people need to hear is that, you know, whether you have an exposure or you have symptoms, it's critically important that you continue to get tested. As we continue to open up the economy, you know, and folks start to do things like return to work, return to more social settings, you know, we've got to institute enough testing to make sure that we have a good handle for where this virus is going.
Do you think that goes to the wayside? You know, we've been very lucky and have been in a corporate setting where testing has been readily available to us on a regular basis. So there is a gut check constantly in terms of our individual situation as well as our community situation. And it's stopped dead in its track. But do you feel like once we get on the other side of it, that this all goes away? Because I'm thinking about the next pandemic, to be quite honest. I talked to a series of CEOs earlier today, you know, household brands, household names, and they're saying, listen, we got to think about the next one because it's coming. And just got about 40 seconds here.
Sure. So, you know, I think it's important to remember that we're extremely fortunate in this country to have, you know, vaccines rolling out aggressively as they are. But this virus is still circulating widely in other parts of the world and is likely to make a return as we get back into the fall and the winter. And so as part of that, if we want to reopen schools and we want to reopen workplaces, you know, it's really important that there's a surveillance testing program in place that's being instituted through employers and through schools so that we have a good idea mm-hmm. when that sort of fall and winter surge starts to come back.
Right.
You know, I think all of us will breathe easier when we're back on the other side of this thing next year and we haven't had a corresponding rise in cases. But until then, we've got to continue to have things like workplace and school-based testing.
Right. Hey, listen, nice to get some time with you and look forward to checking with you again. Dr. Mario Ramirez, emergency physician, managing director of Opportunity Labs, former pandemic and emerging threats coordinator during the Obama administration.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Bloomberg Business Week magazine's been tracking cities and areas around the country impacted by the pandemic. You know that. You've been listening all along to see, though, what was going on in these local economies really is an indicator of maybe what's going on our broader economy. And that includes taking a look at the neighborhood of Seattle's Capitol Hill. Following that neighborhood, Noah Buhier, finance reporter at Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone in Seattle, along with Bloomberg Business Week editor Jill Weber on the Access line in Brooklyn. And Jill, this is a story that's in the upcoming issue of the magazine.
Yeah, that's right. We just had a huge commitment to just doing wonderful small business stories, and Noah's been sort of one of the people leading that charge with his coverage of Seattle and Capitol Hill there. And Noah, tell us about what you found at Big Little News.
Yeah, so, you know, just to set the scene here, I've been following this neighborhood for several months now, and one of the things I've been interested in is just when we would start to see green shoots. I mean, this is a neighborhood that prior to the pandemic saw an incredible amount of change. And it was just sort of the normal course of business was to have new shops and restaurants going in and out just constantly. And what we saw was just, frankly, a lot of stasis for the first several months of the pandemic. I think the number of closures were probably fewer than some folks, you know, had feared at the outset, thanks to a lot of government stimulus. I just sort of kept my eye out for what some of the new, who some of the first movers would be. And somewhat to my surprise, one of the new businesses that cropped up in this neighborhood was a newsstand called Big Little News. And it just crystallized for me sort of the interesting moment we're in that, you know, folks who are starting businesses right now are landing on some counterintuitive business models. You know, for instance, you know, one that relies on selling print magazines, and you know, they're kind of like a bodega. They have some snacks and coffee table books and other things.
Fancy bodega.
Fancy bodega. Exactly. Yes. But yeah, it's like the last business that you would imagine cropping up at a time that's really tough for small retail.
Well, no, that's the crazy part of it, right? It opened in the middle of the pandemic. So what do we think? Is it just all of a sudden there were opportunities to go into commercial space that they could now afford? Is it thank you, the trillions of dollars of stimulus? I mean, there were a lot of things at play, right?
Yes.
Every
small business is going to be different, but yes, for when it comes to this particular one, it was a space that was the right size that came available at a price that made sense for a kind of risky business venture, and you know, it's going to be different. Like Yelp has interesting data about food and restaurant business openings returning to pre-pandemic levels toward the end of last year. And part of that story is about the fact that, you know, as some restaurants have closed, you've had restaurateurs willing to go in and they've been able to go into spaces that are already outfitted with kitchens and, you know, a lot of the capital investment required to start a restaurant, that's taken care of in some of these spaces. So, you know, I think what we're seeing here is the churn of capitalism, and also just sort of this abiding faith that urban neighborhoods are going to get their swagger back, and that people are going to want to live there and have interesting experiences, and you know, all those collisions that make cities wonderful places to be.
So Noah, tell me about Tracy Taylor and where did the spark to get into the newsstand business come from?
Well, the idea had actually been percolating between Tracy and Joey Burgess, who owns a couple of bars in this neighborhood, as well as some other business ventures. Tracy is the longtime manager at an independent bookstore called Elliott Bay here in Seattle and also located in Capitol Hill. And Joey and Tracy had been talking about this idea of opening a newsstand actually for a while, and it was really last year when this particular space opened that they felt like the timing was right to do it.
So what's interesting is, you know, especially I like what you said at the beginning too, Noah, is that I think for a while we were thinking, okay, that's it. You know, commercial, you know, businesses, retail businesses, especially among small business owners, they weren't going to stand a chance. So you kind of give me hope about what's going on and what it says maybe about economic momentum on the other side of this.
Yeah, I think one underappreciated part of this is like if every storefront in some of these urban neighborhoods was vacant and boarded up, people might not be willing to go in and do something new. But the fact of the matter is federal stimulus, some relief from landlords, bank forbearance, a lot of factors basically helped way more small businesses pull through than I think people thought at the beginning of this thing. And the fact that these neighborhoods haven't in many cases haven't been totally decimated, gives, you know, it makes the places feel good enough that, you know, having something new go in doesn't seem like such an insane stretch for entrepreneurs. Even if we're still, you know, months, if not years away from anything like the street life and activity that we saw pre-pandemic.
Well, and you know what's interesting? If I jump in, I was talking to a bunch of CEOs this morning of publicly held companies, and they said, we have to be careful about some of the false narratives that are out there, whether it's with streaming or working from home or hybrid or the demise of cities, you know, and whether it's in the media or elsewhere, or it's by people who have something at stake, like we just need to kind of really look at, Noah, which is what your story does, at what's really happening.
Yeah, and I do want to emphasize, look, this is going to be different in different places. If you just go a mile down the road from Capitol Hill to downtown Seattle, it's still very, very quiet. One of the things that Capitol Hill has going for it is the fact that a lot of people live there. There are lots of apartments, and so there's been some sort of baseline level of street activity to keep these businesses afloat. And we've seen that with a lot of these indie businesses.
Right.
That they have loyal patrons. People were doing takeout from restaurants. When this newsstand opened, you know, they popped in and they had a really good first week because, you know, as Joey Burgess, one of the co-owners, told me, people were just looking for something new.
What is the mood in the neighborhood right now?
And just quickly, got about 10, 15 seconds here.
Look, it's still quiet, but the sun's out. It's springtime. Things are open. I think there's considerably more optimism today than there was a couple months ago.
Got a great way to end. We'll take some optimism. Hey, Noah, thanks so much. Noah Buhire, finance reporter at Bloomberg News from Seattle. Jill Weber, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, on the remote access in Brooklyn.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So we've talked a lot about the gaps in wealth in America and how the system has been stacked repeatedly against Black Americans when it comes to the creation of wealth, whether through housing, incomes, investments, and more. So looking to close that gap are investing influencers to help Black Americans embrace things like stocks, Bitcoin, and more. It's a story on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com caught our attention. And joining us with more is Akayla Gardner, who is a reporter at Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from Columbus, Ohio. Akayla, nice to have you here with us. Tell us a little bit about what you set out to do with this story, what you wanted to look into.
Hi, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Absolutely. I was looking into Clubhouse, obviously, as this emerging social media platform, and really found that people talking about wealth were skewing to be Black Americans. There's these clubs, as they're known on the app, that have grown to 50, 60,000 followers in just a few months, really encouraging Black Americans and really Black people all over the world to start investing in stocks and bitcoins. And most of these people are beginners, never having invested before or really not familiar with Bitcoin. And so the mission of these hosts really is to educate Black Americans who may have not grown up hearing about stocks or index funds or even things like retirement accounts. And so they're really just educating them on how to start and where to begin.
What are you hearing, too, about Black Americans being much more comfortable in an online forum where it's run by another Black American or it's people like themselves kind of in similar situations?
Right. So Clubhouse is still invite only. So I think there is sort of this feeling of privacy still on these groups. And Clubhouse, it can feel a lot like a conversation that I'm having with you right now, like a one-on-one conversation where people are really finding trust in these hosts. Some of the groups meet on a week-to-week basis, and others are meeting hour by hour, almost like a school even. So they really get to know the host and kind of decide if they trust them and if they'll take their advice and really implement it in their lives.
What's interesting, too, and you've got a lot of data points, which I love in your story, and you point out some data that show that while fewer Black Americans invest in stocks than white people, they're actually more receptive to holding cryptocurrencies. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. It's so interesting. Obviously, cryptocurrencies are still so new, but because of the way that cryptocurrencies are set up outside of traditional financial system, outside of really government regulation, I think Black Americans and people of color, also Hispanic investors, feel really comfortable with this currency because it lacks that interference. And they feel disenfranchised really by the system, by institutions, and feel like they haven't been able to access that quote-unquote American dream. And so they see Bitcoin, they see cryptocurrency as an opportunity to build wealth without that interference from a system that they really don't trust.
Don't you feel like that is such a huge concept? Like this whole idea, and we've had a lot of conversations on air about this, about how banks have not been sensitive or receptive to minorities in particular, Black Americans in particular. And so they're really, you know, Blacks have felt left out of the financial system, and they have been largely. And so they're looking for disruptors, people who are doing it differently, because that's what they're finding more comfortable, because they trust that more than maybe they do the traditional system, because the traditional system has left them out.
Right. If you go to, say, a traditional financial advisor or someone who's been in this field for a while, they'll probably tell you, you know, steer clear from Bitcoin. It's not, we don't know much about it. It's unpredictable. But people on these apps, particularly this one group called Black Bitcoin Billionaires, are really going the opposite way and really evangelizing about Bitcoin and encouraging people to buy Bitcoin for their children, to really put their kind of their eggs in this one basket and say, this is really going to build you wealth. And kind of, I wouldn't say making promises, but I think that's also the double-edged sword here, is because they're vulnerable, because a lot of people don't have that background information, it could be putting them at risk, not just with Bitcoins, but with other stocks and things that are being pushed on this app. So users really have to be diligent about getting secondhand information and fact-checking and really seeking financial advice from professionals as well.
Really good point, as you mentioned, and also in your reporting, because you talk about the Black Bitcoin Billionaires, largest cryptocurrency group on the app, about 51,000, almost 52,000 followers. But you're right. I mean, they've got a partnership with Square. Company sponsors Bitcoin giveaways for members through its Cash App. But you're right. Like any investor, you've got to be very careful. Something like Bitcoin, as you know, can be very volatile, and you've got to be very aware in terms of the risk risk-reward when it comes to these investments, right?
Absolutely. And that's why I think people really do have to double check what they're hearing on these apps, and not just Bitcoin. On Clubhouse, they're also talking about things like real estate. And I talked to one user who said that they're pushing properties sometimes, and you have to make sure that the properties are legitimate. And it takes a critical eye or critical ear, I should say, to really make sure that people aren't scamming you. And because of the way that it's set up, you're not really sure who's real and who's who they say they are, you know,
right,
just as it is on any social media platform.
Right. If it sounds too good to be true, it might just be when it comes to an investment. Hey, good stuff. Akayla Gardner, thank you so much. Reporter at Bloomberg News. You can find her at Gardner Akayla on Twitter. She's joining us on the phone from Columbus, Ohio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, folks, just about 9.5 minutes left in today's trading session, and it's time to do the Drive to the Close. Back with us is David Marcus, co-founder and CEO at Evermore Global Advisors, manager of the Evermore Global Value Fund, up 43% in the past year, up about 10% so far this year. David and the fund focusing on special situations and cheap stocks. He also focuses on Europe, and he joins us on the phone from Sevent, New Jersey. David, good to have you back with us. How are you?
Really good, Carol. Thanks for having me back.
Well, talk to me about the market environment and where you're seeing opportunities right now.
I have to say it's really an incredible time in a good way. You have all this pent-up angst. I think people want to get out of their homes. They want to get back to doing things. And we're already seeing a lot of that spend starting to happen. You see companies showing significant increases in revenues across the board in all kinds of divisions. And this is when people are still kind of largely at home or not going out as much. So as the barriers to sort of going out and spending more time outside continue to diminish, the numbers should continue to improve. And that's really happening globally here in the U.S., of course, and we're seeing it in Europe where we spend a lot of our time. And you're having a time here where value and growth have come together. Things are cheap still in a lot of areas. And yet, there's also high growth, which you don't normally get at the same time.
So where is that leading to you in terms of maybe making new purchases, adding to positions? And have you been aggressively kind of changing some of where you want to commit new money?
We change a little slowly, but the fact is businesses that have global opportunities are where we want to be. So, for example, just recently, back in January, a shipping company called Zim, Z-I-M, which is an Israeli company, but they listed here on the New York Stock Exchange, 75-year-old company, and the business is just moving goods around the world, and they're trading at a cheap valuation, yet business is booming. And then with the crisis that they had at the Suez Canal, it kind of just enhanced, at least in the short run, opportunities there. It's interesting. They IPO'd at 15. Immediately the stock went down. Now it's in the high 20s. It's 2 months later, and it's still undervalued because the potential for growth as goods continue to be desired by individuals and business is picking up, there's just not enough ships to really move the goods around. The demand is already so strong, and yet the demand is growing. And then when you layer on top of this, the stimulus programs that are going to come in here, trillions, and in Europe, trillions. Add all that together, I don't know whatever a trillion, trillions plus trillions is, but it's a big number. And so it's companies like that. It's companies like IAC, which is another U.S. company. It's the Barry Diller conglomerate that owns everything from a stake in MGM to Vimeo, Dotdash, Care.com. They own a stake in MGM. It's been a great investment for us, but just yesterday they announced incredible growth in revenue for Angie's List, or now called Angie's Home Services, or in Vimeo. I mean, we're talking between 30 and 60% growth just for the last month. It's one data point. I'm not going to extrapolate 1 month out, but the point is that pickup is huge by customers. And as I say, you're still getting things at fair, if not cheap, prices. And then you have breakups and spinoffs happening. I've talked in the past with you about Vivendi, which is a French company. They control Universal Music Group, which is the largest music company in the world. And they announced they're going to spin it off to shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll trade in Europe, but we expect we'll have an ADR here as well. So before the end of the year, you're going to have access to owning a stake in Universal Music, which is Taylor Swift and a whole bunch of artists going back from now to 100 years ago plus in their catalog. And the music business has just exploded. And I'm buying Vivendi, the holding company that controls it, for, in our view, just their value of their stake in Universal Music. And we're getting all their other businesses for free. They have a mobile gaming business. They have Havas, one of the largest advertising groups in the world. They have stakes in companies throughout the media and telecom spectrum across Europe. And you're getting those for almost nothing just for the value of their stake in the music company.
Right. Well, it's so interesting, too. Well, what do you make, too, though? David, what do you make, too, of, you know, you've got a lot of musicians kind of buying their catalogs. Like, there's a lot of interesting plays right now in terms of music catalogs and being sold. You know, we're all about content, and that includes music.
Yes. Well, look, it's happening. And Universal is competing with Sony and others to buy these catalogs. And some of these artists have realized that there's another round of ways for them to capitalize on all of the decades of work they have generated. And so it's exactly what you're saying. It's all about content. We're in a land grab phase now where they're competing with each other. It's probably fantastic for the artists that still control their rights well, because the numbers are getting crazy, but in the long run, if you're an integrated company where you can take the catalog, put it into your video games, put it into your movies, put it into other things that you're doing, you get an incredible leverage effect. And if you don't have those other verticals, you can license them for those things. So it is about having the content, and being some of the largest players, I think, is so important. And it is becoming a much global business.
Right.
You know, and the market's opportunities in Asia is exceptional as Universal Music continues to grow all around the world and partner and take stakes in companies there.
Hey, David,
just
got about 40 seconds left, and I just want to quickly get to one more company. You like AAC Interactive. What's your take there?
Oh, well, that's it. That's IAC. That is the Barry Diller company. I mentioned it earlier.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
They're going to IPO Vimeo in the coming months. And they basically buy, build, scale up, and then spin off businesses.
Right.
They
Known
spun
for
off
that.
Match.com last summer. And the value creation for shareholders, they've compounded at an incredible rate. And we just see this continuing over and over and over. This is one of those great compounders where they're working for us as shareholders 24/7 to create value, because they benefit as well. Everybody's aligned here. And so we love IAC, absolutely. It's one of our favorite holdings.
Forgive me, a little multitasking, so I was a little distracted. But no, you're right. This is a company that has a lot of brands under its umbrella, and you often see a lot of movement around there. Hey, David, always good to get some time with you. David Marcus, Chief Executive Officer at Evermore Global Advisors.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.